how was I able to do a lot of this stuff? My self-centeredness and selfishness was so powerful that it actually, the only thing that was real to me was not its impact on you, not your suffering, not how I presented in the world, not what was going to happen to my children, but my own suffering was the only thing that was real to me. I don't believe in thieving. I don't believe in lying. But you know what? I'm a survivor. And it's not pretty. The first thing I have to do is quit playing God. Now, part of the complication here as a sponsor and as a member of AA and as a personal, so as somebody who personally needs to experience step three in order to survive, there's also a line between being playing God and being irresponsible. It's a slippery slope. It's an interesting thing. You know, when a guy calls me and reports to me that his brother-in-law's kind of pissed him off and he thinks really the best thing for him to do is, you know, to get out in the middle of the night and, you know, and cut the guy's brake lines, you know, on his all his vehicles so that he dies in a flaming car crash. To not play God, to really not play God, I would just say, okay, fine, you know, maybe, you know, after you kill me, you'll write a resentment against yourself or something. Or I can insinuate myself into the process in a loving way. There's a difference between being irresponsible and playing God and walking that line and taking a look at it. I, at this point, at 22 years of sobriety, I have erred on the side of not playing God a lot. I really have. I am trying to find a way to be responsible in a way, in a loving way. Guy called me one night, he was going to kill himself, and I acted responsibly. I did what the citizens do. I called the police. That's what citizens do. I want to kill myself. Well, you know, call me when you're serious about this thing. Click. I called the cops. I go over there, and the cop said, we just think he's had too much to drink. And I go, oh, really? I go in, he stands up. The whole time he's talking to the cops, he's sitting on a butcher knife. The entire time, you know? So I didn't err on the side of not playing God. I took that kind of action. One of the things I love, and I've heard this from newcomers so many times, is, you know, a new guy will say, you know what, I was with some people smoking crack last night, and I really felt comfortable. You know, it wasn't hard for me. And part of the insane thing there is we forget it's illegal. You know, I'm really glad you're comfortable. You know, when Jonah got out of the belly of the whale, he didn't go back in to get his hat. You know, there's a line of irresponsibility there. We had to quit playing God. It didn't work. Next, we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He is the principal. We are his agents. He is the father. We are his children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we pass to freedom. And it talks about that I'm going to get close to him. I'm going to perform his work well. I got on my knees with my sponsor. We said this prayer together, which I felt was embarrassing and unnecessary, but we did it. I thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could abandon ourselves utterly to him. I don't know what that meant. I didn't go out and buy a robe, you know, but I just did it as good as I could do it at that time. And I want to share with you something because it took me a long time to get this and figure it out, but it was just another gorgeous thing my beautiful sponsor did for me. I had a guy named Don M. was my first sponsor for my first 10 years. We got on our knees and we said this prayer, and he opened his book and we both held hands and we read the prayer from the book. And part of my twisted noodle, part of my brain said, boy, shouldn't you like know this? You know, you've been doing this a long time. I've asked, you know, I'm soliciting your aid here. I think you should know this prayer. Of course he knew the prayer. He didn't want to separate himself from me. He didn't want to be more sober than me. He didn't want to sit there and close his eyes and know it by heart why I had to read it. And he read it with me. What a great, loving, generous thing. And he didn't say it to me. You know, it didn't take me long. About 8 years later, I realized it, you know. But in that time, monkey see, monkey do, I had always held hands and read it with the guy that I was doing it with. The generosity in Alcoholics Anonymous. Next, we launched You know, it says here, you know, it's a funny thing. I had this spiritual sickness, and the only way to get out of it, the only way to get out of this terrible fix I'm in is some kind of spiritual experience. And in the big book of AA, there's just, it's like an internal combustion engine all throughout the book. You know, in step five, it says, in step three, it says sometimes a great effect is felt at once. You know, at the end of step four, on the end of chapter five, it says, and we've, you know, chewed off and swallowed some big chunks of truth about ourselves. In step five, it says, now we really begin to have a real spiritual experience. You know, in the middle of nine, it says that we have, you know, a new peace, a new freedom. We know freedom from fear of financial insecurity. This was written in 1937 to 1939 during global economic collapse. If there had been a PR department working with these guys, they would not have let them put that you will know freedom from fear of financial insecurity. That's the last thing they would have said. Guys, promise them anything. Promise them, and do not promise them that. That's crazy. Nobody can do that in this world that we're living in. They promised it, and they delivered it. And then in step 10, it says that the alcohol problem will be removed. We'll know the correct use of self-will. We won't even be swearing off. The problem will be removed. In 11, it says the occasional hunch or inspiration will actually become a working part of the mind. And in 12, I have had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, and now I'm going to go talk to other people. You know, I was in psychotherapy for 18 years by the time I got to AA. I was going to be dead, but I was going to understand it. And I got no beef against therapy. I'm in therapy now. I get a tremendous amount out of therapy. I really like it. I don't use it to treat my alcoholism. It's like showing up at a gunfight with a knife. It's just a humongous mistake. And never once has any of my therapists, especially before I got sober, shown me a solution and then said, go talk to other people. They mostly said, shh, try to quiet down a little bit. You might want to talk to less people, actually. And you guys have always said to me, we don't care what you've got. Give it away. Just don't give away anything you don't have. And I've made mistakes. I've given away, tried to give away stuff I don't have. It's not pretty. But you said if all you got is a car and a quarter, lend somebody a dime and give them a ride. You know. So this decision that I've made to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him is a great decision. It's we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which was a personal house cleaning, which many of us never attempted. Though the decision was a vital and a crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless followed by a strenuous effort to face and to be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. There are three sections to the inventory, as is explained in the book. There's a section on resentments that we're asked to write twice on. There's a section on fears we're asked to write once on. And there's a section on sex, which we're asked to write a story on. The section on sex, to me, is really become more about my life and the way that I want to be in the world, the kind of man that I would be. It says in Doctor's Opinion, Silkworth talks about that we long felt that some form of moral psychology was required. And I always wondered what the hell moral psychology is, you know, and I get it now. And I want to tell you this story because it's a great story. I have a friend named Bobby, and unfortunately he doesn't get asked to talk a lot in AA. He's quite a guy. And he came off Skid Row in L.A., which is a tough place to come off of. He had alcoholic paralysis. And he was going to kill himself. He climbed up to a bridge in Los Angeles and said, Pop, I'm done. What had happened an hour before is he had gone back to his house with his three daughters and took off his crunchy clothes. His wife let him come in to take a shower. And when he got out of the shower, he heard his five-year-old daughter say to his wife, when are you going to realize that you can't make a daddy out of that creepy man? And he put his filthy clothes on and he walked out and he walked up to a bridge in L.A. and said, just let me know because I got to go. And a wind came up and pushed him back off the bridge, and he walked down to a payphone and called AA, and he's never had another drink. He's a great guy. And he made this deal with God about his physical health, which was failing, about if he got better, he'd run the marathon in L.A., and he got better.
And he went down to sign up for the marathon. He was a couple of years sober. And they had this card. The L.A. Times had people filling out a card to say why he wanted to run the marathon. And he wrote down the reason. And the guys down on Skid Row read the article that was published on him, because the marathon runs through Skid Row, and the guys down there put together a cheering section for him when he ran through. Bobby came off a place called Harbor Lights, which is a Salvation Army deal down on the Nickel in L.A., and they have a thing called the Hall of Miracles, where people who have come off the Nickel off Fifth Street and have stayed 3 years sober, they put them into the Hall of Miracles. They have this lovely little thing. And I went down there for his induction into the Hall of Miracles. And one kind of heartbreaking thing is there were no news cameras down there. What a missed opportunity, you know. And there's you. You're there, dressed pretty and smiling and comfortable. All these families and kids running around. And the Salvation Army guy said something about the kids there that just changed. I used to sometimes come into an AA meeting, if there was a kid there, I'd do my traditional snubbing and glowering a little bit, you know, my prejudge. And, you know, if a kid's whacking you in the back of the head through an entire meeting, it's probably not a good idea. But he just was, this guy from the Salvation Army was a tremendous help to me. He said that thing I said before. It's not, didn't originate with me. He said, today, if the children are difficult or maybe distracting, just remember that it's the music of families that shouldn't be together. And I've just loved that. So I'm sorry that apparently this child's been ejected. But resentment's no big deal. It's just the source of all spiritual illness and the great destroyer of alcoholics. Don't be alarmed. It'll cut you off from the sunlight of the spirit, drag your ass out, and kill you dead. But work a step a year. Relax. It's going to kill me. It's going to eat my brain and my heart and turn my life black and throw me out of my own life. There won't be room for me in my own life. Not when I'm re-experiencing my hatred of you. And here's an added terror. That somehow, if I don't stay invigorated and having a robust, exciting experience at AA, it starts becoming okay for me to have certain resentments as a sober person. You know? And I try to wish them away. I try to pray them away. And I start having recidivism. I start having the same resentment coming up again and again. I start suffering from the same thing again and again. And I start losing hope. And if I don't start expanding my experience, my spiritual tools, and my way to implement them as a member of AA, I start feeling like I'm on a spiritual hamster wheel, and it starts going below the horizon and stop presenting itself as a real piece of business, and I go mad. And one of the guys I sponsor have asked me, do you still do inventory? And I always say to them, you'll know when I stop. I will not be particularly interested in what's going on with you. I will not. I might act it, but you know when you act it, people know. Sometimes when a guy's not so self-obsessed, but he's really not paying attention. But and the book is real clear about this. I'm resentful at Scott for being a terrible father. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. Please don't take anything I'm saying as an indictment of what you're doing in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just sharing my stuff, I'm not sharing at you. I'm sharing with you, and I'm just here to tell you what I do. I understand people use the phrase, what was my part? And I understand that it's very helpful to a lot of people. It's not a phrase that I use. I'm resentful at Nazis for slaughtering Jews during World War II. What's my part? No, I don't have a part. I don't see it that way. Again, this can be semantics. Okay, what the phrase "my part"'s not even, it's nowhere in the first 164 pages of the big book. Oh, and again, I'm not indicting it. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just sharing what I've required to see this clearly for me. It says, what are the defects in me that if God would remove, the resentment would be gone? Right? The first thing that was apparent was that this world and its people were often quite wrong.
But again, don't read the next page, because what the next page says is you're right and you're dead. You are dead because you experienced this in a way that is so injurious to you, you can't live your life while you're experiencing this thing. You know, I wake up, I think about it. I think about that guy. Would everybody join me in the Lord's Prayer? Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever. Amen. Do you guys use that prayer at your home group at all? Okay. You just said, almost everybody here, I think, just said the prayer. You said, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. I want you to do a 15-second contemplation right now. Okay, you can close your eyes or keep them open and ask yourself, is there anybody or anything in your life you're not forgiving? Thank you. If there's anybody or anything in your life you're not forgiving, why'd you say the prayer? You just said, forgive me my trespasses as I forgive those who trespass against us. Why do I keep saying this prayer? I say it at almost every meeting I go to. Now, if you've never read the Sermon on the Mount, I just want to tell you that Emmett Fox, the guy who wrote, it's a book called Sermon on the Mount. In the back of the book, there's this really remarkable section on the Lord's Prayer. And he takes each sentence in the Lord's Prayer and writes a chapter about it. And the chapter that he writes about forgiveness is one of the most powerful, life-changing experiences I've ever had. He basically says, Fox says, if you're saying this prayer and you're not forgiving, he says basically, you should choke on the words. And he suggests not saying the prayer until you forgive. Otherwise, why are you saying it? It becomes a very flat, empty pursuit. A hastily mumbled thing. It's not even a prayer. It's the end of the meeting. You know? And I don't want to live that way. I don't want things to flatten out. I don't want them to be sucked dry of the possible spiritual growth opportunity that's there. So one of the things that Fox says at the end of the chapter on Forgive Us Our Trespasses, he says that one practice that's really helped him is he says that every day, he's part of his morning deal, is he forgives everyone for everything. I forgive everyone for everything. So I started doing it. No, I started trying to do it. And what starts happening in my head is I forgive everyone for everything. And my brain goes, him? You're forgiving him? Her? That? That government? The people who are murdering people in Darfur? You're going to forgive them? And I started having to deal with this idea of forgiveness. Again, do I excuse the people who are committing genocide in Darfur? No. No. Do I forgive them? If I don't, I'm dead. Does forgiveness mean that I don't take action? No. Does forgiveness mean that I don't give money to operations that I hope are victorious? No. It doesn't mean any of that. The Bhagavad Gita is a wonderful, wonderful Hindu tract. And if you've never read it, it's really quite marvelous. And there are these, the Bhagavad Gita takes place on a battlefield where two warring factions, most of them relatives. One of my favorite playwrights, Anton Chekhov, when he was describing what the theater should be, what his idea of the theater should be, he said, theater should be like eating dinner with your family. Nothing is said during the meal except for pass the salt and more butter, please. And yet by dessert, your life is destroyed. So there, welcome to my house. And so on this battlefield, a god, they don't know he's a god, and this one of the heroes of the battle are talking. And the relatives are about to slaughter people. So it's about life. It's about being on the battle. And what the message is, what they say is, keep your brain in the cloud, in the fight. Keep your brain in the sponsorship. Keep your brain in the group. Keep your brain at your job. Keep your brain in your marriage. Keep your brain in those relationships. And keep your heart at the lotus feet of the Lord. You know, what does it say in the chapter to the family afterwards? It says we feel that God wants us to have our head in the clouds and our feet on the ground. You know, and I love that. I love the spirit of that, you know, a lot. So with forgiveness, as I've done this morning, that morning declaration, it points up to me where I'm not forgiving. It points up to me where I'm re-experiencing and I'm, you know, I'm denying rain to either the thorns or the flowers. I'm saying love is here. I'm a part of the big spiritual democracy of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I'm not part of that democracy, I'm putting myself on an ice floe and I'm eventually going to die. How can I continue to do that? And again, there is behavior that's not excusable, but it's all got to be forgivable. I heard in AA, you know, that my parents didn't do a good job, but it's the best that they could do. And you know what? That's fine, but they really did a bad job. I was really injured as a kid. And they did the best they could, but I'm not interested in patting them on the back for that. Its job at times just sucked, you know. And I forgive them absolutely and completely or I'm going to die. It's not excusable, but it is forgivable. I'm resentful at Nazis for slaughtering Jews during World War II. What are the defects in me that if God would remove, the resentment would be gone? What are the defects? Blue skies. God's got a magic wand. I'm not going to talk about if it's possible for these things to be removed. I don't know. I'm going to tell you what it is in me that if God would remove the resentment, we'd be gone. Let's go back to father. I'm resentful at Scott for being a lousy father. And I was. Now, I did good stuff. And I did a lot of bad stuff. And at the end of the day, the bad far outweighed the good. My sons have received 22 birthday gifts on the day of their birthday that they wanted. Not once in 22 years have they received the day after radioactive guilt gift from the only place that would still take a hot check from me. You know, here's some drywall, boys. You know? Kids are loving the drywall. My younger son's birthday is in a couple of weeks, and I spent the weekend with him last weekend, and I had that great talk with him. Jess, what do you want for your birthday, man? We had this great talk about it. You know, he wants a certain kind of belt buckle. Non-representational. You know, he doesn't want it to be like the portrait of somebody. We just had this great time, you know. I did things on my son's birthdays in my house that I would not share publicly in an AA group. They were so injurious and so embarrassing. And God, I'm such a good parent now. And I'm not saying I don't make mistakes, but I'm resentful at Scott for being a bad father. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. A five-bagger for sure. What is it in me that if God would remove the resentment, would be gone? Well, I'm ashamed and I'm guilty. I'm not trusting in God. If I trusted in God, I would stop punishing myself the way I am. At the time I wrote this, I had to write I'm impatient because I'm not giving myself a chance to do the right thing. You know, I was pretty new. It was my fourth step. I was fresh out of being a bad father, so I was impatient. You know, it says in the chapter of the family afterward, we tend to try to get something done real quick because it's so awful when you actually stop drinking and you take the whooping. You know, if I really had gotten the enormity of a lot of the injury I'd done, if I really had gotten it, I don't know that I could have stayed here. I think it just would have broke my back. I couldn't fit the pain in my head. Thank God. If I had remembered everything, I would have looked like an outtake from Scanners. My head would have blown up, you know. It came to me slowly, and it came to me, and it was really revealed. As you know, it's like a dentist, you know, when a dentist takes that little tool and gets a pinprick and opens it, and it's like the Carlsbad Caverns in there. That's very similar to a lot of the inventory I've done, where I'll take one item, and it'll kind of open a little world there that I've got to take a look at. And there's a difference between self-examination and self-obsession. If this stuff and this self-examination is not connected to changing the way I behave and finding and asking about solutions and finding people who in the problem seems to have been solved, then it's just going to become a self-fulfilling prophecy after a while, you know. What are the other defects? I'm punishing. And you know what? Another defect is I'm irresponsible. I was an irresponsible father. It's true that I was a bad father. That's the truth. You know, why does it feel bad? Because it was. I'm dishonest. I'm filled with self-delusion. And it's interesting. A defect for me, a very interesting defect, is fear of confrontation. Years ago, my older son, Micah, I was, I think, about 4 years sober by this time, so he was about 10, and Jesse was 7. And Jesse broke his wrist in a schoolyard accident. And in a little kid, it got broken in a growth plane, which is cartilage that turns to bone. And if it gets disrupted, if it gets set, you can't mess with it, because if it doesn't heal right, it can be a bad permanent deal for the kid. So he gets a cast. He's a younger brother, so it's a weapon. The cast is a weapon. And he gets home, and, you know, the playing field's a little more level now with the cast, which he's delighted about. So he wants to show his brother his cast up close and personal as quick as he can. And, you know, they're boys. They're beating the crap out of each other in about 10 minutes. And it had to be zero tolerance. I couldn't let him do this, because if it screwed up his arm, it would be bad. It wasn't something I could repeat 11 times, you know. So I got up in Micah's face and I yelled at him, and I just shut it down. And Micah, who's 10, turned away from me, stormed into his room, and slammed the door. So he slammed the door. So I got the dad tick going now. I slammed the door, you know. And I go to the door, I open the door, and before I can unload on him, he looks up at me and he says, "Hold it a second. I didn't say you were wrong out there. You were right about what you were saying. But a huge guy just got in my face and screamed and yelled. I didn't say you were wrong. Don't tell me I can't be mad." What the hell is that? What is that? Well, it was something he had been watching his mother and I doing with varying degrees of success and failure. I know how to repress, just crush it back down and wind up climbing into a clock tower with a high-powered rifle, you know. I know how to bully you, scream and yell, or cry. Either one's fine with me. I've always enjoyed the tyranny of helplessness or the volume. Volume or crying, either one's fine in a pinch. But to stand up for myself and tell you how I feel without telling you what to do, to take no crap and to give no crap, wow, that's overcoming a fear of confrontation. And that's what Micah did in that moment. He didn't say, "I was wrong." He didn't say, "Don't talk to me that way." He said, "I get it. It made me angry. Don't tell me I can't be angry. I'm not telling you that you're not wrong. I am respecting you, and you ought to respect me. I don't know if you're gonna, but you ought to, because I'm respecting me by doing this." What a remarkable thing that is, you know. And fear of confrontation has appeared as a defect in my inventory many, many times, you know, because there's times I need to really sit down and explain a few things to my boss, and I don't want to overcome a fear of confrontation. I want to give him a piece of my mind, no matter how small a piece it might be by that time. I would like to share it, and it's usually a pretty small piece by that time. Or I'm not going to say anything, and I'm going to suffer. But to tell you how I feel without telling you what to do, man, that is really an extraordinary thing. I'm resentful at Nazis for slaughtering Jews during World War II. What are the defects of character in me that if God would remove the resentment would be gone? What are the defects of character in me that if God would remove the resentment would be gone? What a great question to ask myself about each resentment. What is it specifically in this resentment that if God were to remove? Now, is it the same all the time? No. No. Is it similar? Quite often similar. But there's different elements to it. And I want to be,
I don't want to talk about how many Bill Wilsons can dance on the head of a pin. I don't want to micromanage this thing. But I like to be specific. When I go to God in 6 and 7, or I go to him in 3, and I say, Pop, I'm yours. And he says, well, yeah, I'm God. I knew that. It's awfully generous of you, but I kind of got that already. You know, I'm God. And I say, take me. And he goes, well, yeah, sure, what? And I go, well, take this. Take this, take this. What can I do? I need your help. What kind of demonstration can I make? How can I use this as a fire-starting moment, a flashpoint, a doorway to change or to understanding or to love or to forgiveness? How can I empathize? Empathy is not excuse. Empathy, I used to think pity was pathetic. I used to think that pity was patronizing. But the defect of being unpitying is a terrible sickness. I can't be helpful to all people, but I must at least take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one, you know. And so when I did this thing against Nazis, my sponsor told me that thing, that Gord, because I said, let's try none. I have no defects here. We're talking about Nazis. What the hell are you talking about? And Don said to me, he changed my life in that moment. I had no idea how much he was turning my ship. But when he said to me, you don't understand the question. They're not asking if the event was your fault. They're asking if the resentment was your fault. Was the event your fault? No. Was the event my fault around my aunt abusing me? No. Is the resentment my fault? Every time, without a loophole and an exception. What would a normal person do if they were against Nazis or disliked my aunt for abusing them? They might do a lot of stuff. In the case of the Nazis, they might work against the Nazis, join political organizations that fight them. They might contribute funds to those organizations. They might carry the good news. They might do a lot of stuff. But I didn't do any of that stuff. I just talked a lot of long crap and never got out of the house. So what are the defects in me? Well, I'm an opportunist. I kind of use this for my own deal. I was filled with self-pity. Self-pity is, if you could bottle self-pity, it would knock crack off the market in a week. It's just better. It's more available. I get a little lump in my throat. My eyes water up. I lean forward. It's good dope, man, you know. And it really is a narcotic. Isn't that the truth for me, for sure? And as we talked about, when I say we, I mean me. As I talked about in the beginning of the workshop, I've got to get rid of this selfishness. I've got it, or it kills me. You know. So when I write this inventory, I like to be as specific as I can with God. Selfish, self-centered, and self-seeking. Selfish is kind of wanting it all for me. Self-seeking is trying to figure out what's in it for me. And self-centered is kind of figuring that it's all about me. So they're the same and they're different. They're a little spin, a little different English on them. And again, I like to be as specific as I can when I go to my father in that fire starting moment of 6 and 7. You know. You know what I think I'm going to do, guys? I think we're going to take one more break and then drive it through to lunch. Why don't we do that? And I'm starting to talk about 6 and 7. I feel a shift coming on here. So why don't we take 5 minutes, try to keep it to 5, and then we'll have one more session. And if you got them, smoke them. And I'm an alcoholic. Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, the wisdom to know the difference. We got some stuff in the basket. I want to address that, and then we'll finish up by noon. And I just want to talk about step 4. Probably maybe wheedle my way into step 5 a little bit before we break. Someone wrote, "What happened with the AA group written up in Newsweek, and why did they get written up?" It's in last week's Newsweek. It's the group called the Midtown Group in Washington D.C. I'm not breaking their anonymity. It's in Newsweek. The accusations were they participate in sexual exploitation of young women, and that there was they presented. I thought it was such a well-written article.
because they the writer says this is a splinter group from AA, which I'm sure that many members of the group don't view themselves as a splinter group from AA. But and they say that this is outside of the what's accepted as the mainstream tenets of Alcoholics Anonymous. So they don't present it as an indictment of Alcoholics Anonymous. There was a news story there because there was some accusations made by a young woman who said that she was exploited. The other thing that I think was attractive as a news item is that the report included the fact that they were had cordoned themselves off, that people were throwing away people's cell phones, they were told not to call people, they were told not to attend meetings outside of that group. So that's the basic idea. It's on the web. It's out there. It's weird. And in my area, there's some AA groups that have separated themselves from Alcoholics Anonymous, both in Al-Anon and AA. My wife and I, a lot of people who have felt very deeply wounded by these groups have come to me and my wife for help. And some of the men I sponsor, I've had incredible experiences watching them open their heart and their minds and just seeing that there's a different way, just that there's a different way. Many of the people who come to me wounded from other AA groups cannot bear being treated well. And they move on. And they, when someone comes to me and says, I need someone to kick my ass, I go, thanks for playing. You'll be finding someone else because I'm not, I can't imagine why I would want to be your ass kicker. Why would I want it? Why is it going to be my job to rope in your superego and punish your libido and your id? I can come up with something else during the day I'd rather do, you know. But that's just me. I mean, this is why God made more than one of us. You know, I mean, I've shared at meetings that this ass-kicking thing is something I've avoided, and I've had people come up to me afterwards and say, well, it saved my life. I'm not saying you shouldn't do it. I'm just sharing my personal experience. Is there anything you would suggest to help with over-sober? Yes, absolutely, and I'll tell you exactly what I've done. I'm resentful at the North Hollywood group for being a bunch of sick, moronic, hurtful people. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. The North Hollywood group is a big, big AA group. A lot of people go there. A lot of people say they're being helped there. These meetings, I have attended them, and I have wanted to take my own life during the meeting. My sponsor gave me three tools to make my way through unpleasant sharing. These are the three tools. He said, remember that everything in Alcoholics Anonymous needs to be said. You might not be on the list of people who needs to hear it. How many times have I taken a newcomer to a meeting, and it has been the worst meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous ever held? And I think, well, so much for that 12-step call. They'll be running, screaming into the night. And we walk out, and the guy turns to me and goes, man, that was absolutely amazing. Can we come back here next week? And I'm thinking, sure, if you shoot me in the lips, maybe I'll come back here. Everything that gets said at an AA meeting needs to be said, even though don't make me the arbiter, you know. The second thing he said to me is he said, are you willing to take the following chance with your life? When the guy is sharing something you don't want to hear, are you willing to go to the podium, tap him on the shoulder, and say, shut the hell up and sit down because I'm going to talk now? And so far, I'm not saying I haven't wanted to do that, but I haven't been willing to take that chance with my life. And the third thing he said to me is, when it's going on and you're listening to it, remember, they're going to stop. They're going to stop. It's going to end. And when I'm in the middle of it, it feels like it's not going to end. I was a long time ago in my home group. A guy walked up to this. This is a guy who, when he shared, people literally threw ropes over the rafters. They hung themselves while this. It was like that airplane movie where people kill themselves anytime the guy started. This is what this guy was like. Blah 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 blah. And he walked up to me at the end of a meeting, and he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, "You know what? You really haven't been there for me, and I need to move on with sponsorship." I had no recollection of him ever asking me to sponsor him. I had no recollection of ever sponsoring him. All I got was the good part, getting fired. It was like all I got was the whipped cream. I just got the good stuff, you know. At any rate, the way I have avoided being over sober is when I write these resentments against these groups or against people who I think are doing it really bad and people who I think are misusing Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the defects that comes up over and over again is spiritual pride. Now, I didn't get spiritual pride till I came into AA and became a spiritual Goliath. I didn't come in with equipped with spiritual pride. I got it here. I caught spiritual pride here. So if I'm really going to get out of spiritual pride, number one, it doesn't mean that I have, acceptance is not compliance. It's not. Acceptance is accepting so that I can keep my head in the clouds and my feet on the ground, so I can keep my head in the fight and my heart at the lotus feet of the Lord, you know? So I can overcome a fear of confrontation and express myself without having, I can make an evaluation without a judgment. I can move through the landscape of that thing with a good heart. You know, when I just told you about the Midtown group, I didn't say they were bad. I don't know that. I know what I want to be around and not be around. I know that I have been called by injured members of that group, and I didn't believe them at first about what was going on. And then I started, the testimony was, you know, it was, I could only go la, 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 la after a while if I didn't want to buy it. So that's what is, that has been the main gateway to prevent me from being over sober is being able to write the resentments against them, and then eventually the resentments against myself. It says in our book, when it was remorse, we were sore at ourselves. And I don't know about you, but the resentments against myself have been horrible. I do inventories now. Sometimes no one else but me shows up on it. I want to challenge an idea that you might have. Why, and I'm going to present it as myself, but I'm asking you at the same time, why am I so willing to believe the worst about myself? Why? I don't believe the worst about you. I met you this morning. I thought the best of you before you even walked in. I thought, oh, well, remember, this group's going to show up and it'll be fun and we'll have a chat and, you know, we did. You know, it was, I thought the best of you before I met you. You know, why am I not willing often to afford myself that beautiful privilege, that opportunity? Why am I so willing? It's a bad idea. It's a bad idea, and I want to put it on the table. Nothing, St. Paul said, nothing can stand the light. Everything disappears when it's held up to the light. Rumi, the great Sufi poet, says everything, the past and the future, is burnt up by the light. Very few things can withstand God's truth. And I find in AA that once you start telling the truth, it's hard to stop. You know? I'm not talking about hurtful truth. When people, Brent and I were talking about this the other day, when I've had some amends made to me in AA that have been some of the most deranged amends I've ever heard. You know, I used to think you were a disgusting bozo, but I don't anymore. Oh, good. What book are you reading? I judge no man. Putting your partner in a relationship before yourself, or selfishness. Well, I find this to be, for me, I believe in self-interested altruism. I believe that in this death of self, I am being self-serving in the most wonderful way possible. I believe that I can't, that if myself and my, whoever it is, my wife or my sons or my associates, if we both put 50% into the deal, that we're going to wind up with 50%, that the only way to do it is to put 100% in. One of the main ways of two defects that keep me from doing this is mind reading and not living in today, and also blackmail. Blackmail is another big defect of mine. If you do this, I'll do this, or I would do this, but I don't think you've done enough of this. I don't think you had the right facial expression when you just gave that to me. It's like the Scott Redmond mime theater, I call it. I believe, for me, that my demonstrations, my acts of charity, of love, and of service are all self-serving in the most wonderful way possible, that it's self-interested altruism. And for me to say that it's not, for me personally,
It's just simply not true. I've never seen people get more out of being good than I do in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a perfect spiritual machine. It's a spiritual engine that's fed by self-seeking and opportunism, the best kind possible, you know. So for me to put my partner first, I rarely do it anonymously. I might try to do it anonymously, but eventually the anonymous engine breaks down and I'll, by the way, did you see that at all? Did you notice that there were no dirty dishes? Chris Rock does one of the things in one of his routines, which I love. He says, a guy said to him, you know, I've never been to jail. And Rock says, you're not supposed to go to jail. He says, because the guy's kind of bragging about it. He says, you're not supposed to, you know. And, you know, I'll go, you know, I did the dishes. You're supposed to do the dishes. I think that it's some way that housework should equal sex. That there should be like conversion tables on the back of cleaning products of housework to sex, you know. So that's how giving I'm being, you know. I whenever I share that, there's always one guy who thinks marketing, you know, he really. The thing I have found about putting my partner first, about being of service and being helpful, is, you know, one of the things I say to the guys I sponsor, and I really mean it, is I say, give me the whole story and spare me no details. I want to hear the whole story. When a guy calls me, and some of the guys I sponsor actually say, how are you? It's not a common plight that they have, but some of them. I don't think I've ever gotten off the phone with Brent Swift and him not saying, how are you? You know, which makes me feel very cared for. Quite often, I'll say, you know what, let's skip me and go right to you. I need you, pal. I need to know the whole thing. And I'll lay on my bed sometimes and put the phone next to me so I can hear it, and I'll literally feel self fall away. But with no 10, there's no 12. I will eventually get over sober. I will separate myself. So what I'm getting to with my partner, with putting my partner first, is it becomes a great joy for me. It tickles me. It's a curiosity that I would do such a thing. My family, before I got sober, we were driving on a road called Rim of the World. It's a gorgeous road up in the mountains above L.A. And my whole family is going, and they're looking out at this panorama, and they're going, oh, that's so beautiful. And I'm going, yeah, it really is. And all of them realize all at once that I was looking at myself in the rearview mirror, that I was not, and they just went, oh, dude, you're in deep trouble. So it's a problem, but that demonstration of putting my partner first, I've jettisoned the idea that I'm good, and that it's a delight to me. I hope that's helpful. And you mentioned a Hindu tract that was a good read. Will you please spell the name? I don't know how to spell the name. It's Bhagavad Gita. I bet you if you go to the library and you mention it, they'll know exactly what you mean, but I don't know. It's a weird spelling, but it's the Bhagavad Gita. It's part of a bunch of books that are the holiest books for the Hindus, and it's one section, which is about this battle. It's a great battle. So what are the defects of character in me that if God would remove the resentment would be gone? I'm resentful at X for being an AA blowhard and big shot, affecting my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. What are the defects of character? Well, I'm jealous. I'm jealous. I am a bully and a hypocrite because I want to teach them the lesson that they're trying to teach other people. Right. I have spiritual pride. And I'm unwilling to accept the fact that another child of God could be spiritually sick like me. Now, if I could accept the fact that they were spiritually sick, I wouldn't resent any of them. I'd show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience I would cheerfully grant the sick friend. I'm unwilling to accept the fact that X, and I put the name in so it's not sort of a mechanical rubber stamp, I'm unwilling to accept the fact that X is another child of God who could be spiritually sick like me. Why do I say could? Because it says I have to quit playing God. So I'm not going to say is spiritually sick. I don't know if they're spiritually sick. It's possible. And I'm unwilling to even accept the possibility. So they're not just one of God's kids who could be spiritually sick. They're a bunch of hosebags who should die in a flaming car crash. Right? And when I have enough people in the lazy Susan of my mind who have to die, they have to die. They have to die or be exposed. They have to die, be exposed, be punished. Be punished. Either one's fine. Or a combination of three. Punish them, expose them, then kill them. That's really the best. Because I don't just dislike these people. I re-experience the hatred. When I wake up, I water it like a little flower. I want to make sure it's good and it's robust and it's growing and well cared for. The worst thing for me is when I forget to hate something, you know. And like a guy will go, hi. And I go, hi. Oh, I hate him. Why did I do that? Oh, no. Now I'm going to have to like redouble my snubbing just to like get back to where we were, where I thought he knew I hated him, you know. Isn't he reading my mind? It's a short read, believe me, but isn't he reading my mind? You have enough of this activity. I'm sorry, you don't have a life. Let me rephrase that. I have enough of this activity. I don't have a life. I just don't, you know. So this defect of being unwilling to accept the fact that another child of God could be spiritually sick. Now, when I write it, I'm resentful at Scott for being a bad father. It's a little different. I know I'm spiritually sick. It says on page 65, we've not only been mentally and physically sick, we've been spiritually sick. If you're an alcoholic, you're spiritually sick. I know I'm an alcoholic. So when I write the defect about me, I say, I am unwilling to accept the fact that Scott is another child of God who is spiritually sick. If I could accept the fact that I'm spiritually sick, I'd show myself the same tolerance, pity, and patience I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. I know that people use a practice. It's a lovely practice of praying for people they're resentful for. It's never been useful for me. I know that it's useful. Guys I sponsor do it. It's just, I'm not a suicide guy. I'm a homicide guy. I've always vastly preferred your death to mine. I always have. You know, you first. The headline I've always seen in my head is Scott Redmond kills wife, kills children, and refuses to commit suicide. You know, that's always the one. And I'm not, and this is not an indictment of the suicide people. I am not knocking the suicide people here. It's just kind of the flip side of the same coin, really, you know. But for me, you're first. And so I had a lot of resentments against people, a lot of resentments against people. And one of the things my sponsor urged me to do was to ask myself a question. When you write a resentment against somebody, ask yourself, do you have a resentment against yourself in connection with this resentment? Let's try to clean out the whole cavity. That's been very helpful to me. Many times I don't. I just hate you. I'm fine with just hating you. But sometimes there's some extracurricular activity and I throw myself into the fire too, you know. I'm supposed to write resentments against people, institutions, and principles. So the institutions for me were, you know, a lot of governments. There was government of South Africa, government of the Soviet Union. Some banks, some religious institutions, some schools. And principles are really interesting. If we're really truthful, we'll really step up to that, you know. There's the Christian ethic, work ethic is a principle, you know. Doing to others is a principle. Racism is a principle. And the reverse of racism, you know, which is that all races are okay. That's a principle. I've had sponsor a guy who used to have a picture of a Nazi flag in his room. And I sponsored him. And because I had done my inventory and I had written the resentment against Nazis, and I had written the defects of character, and I had prayed about it, and I had forgiven, you know. And I started sponsoring him. He did an inventory. He read me the inventory. There was a lot of really horrific stuff, as you can well imagine, on the inventory. And a couple of years later, when my older son was bar mitzvahed, this guy called me and said, what should I wear to the bar mitzvah and what is an appropriate gift to bring? Yeah. I don't know how many places that's happening, but I know it's happening at our house. You know, a couple of years after that, he asked me if I could marry him and his wife. They got me I don't know what the word is, but credited, or I was legally made a deputy commissioner of marriages in the county of Los Angeles for one day, and I legally married them. I don't think that went out on the Nazi Gazette that night, you know. And I got to marry legally anybody I wanted that day. I wanted to go down on like Skid Row and just like marry everybody. You know, it's just such a cool feeling to be able to marry. And then it went to my head. Like, do you? You do? You're married. but what a day. What an extraordinary day, you know, that was. Without the inventory, that day certainly doesn't take place, you know. It says, after we write our resentments against people, institutions, and principles, against myself, when it was remorse, I was sore at myself, and I write the corresponding defects of character. One thing I like to do is I like to write the resentments and then write the individual defect list for each resentment. They don't have to be 40 pages long. Again, I'm not talking about micromanaging or making this impossible. It could be 3, 4, 5 defects. Not a big deal. The reason why is I like to read, I'm resentful at Scott for being a bad father, what it affects, what the defects are, and I like to have it on a different piece of paper. I number them so the corresponding list is there. Because when I go to God in 6 and 7, I'm going to go to God with the defect list, not the resentment list. I like to put that resentment list aside and just go to him with the thing that's killing me. What's killing me is this spiritual tapeworm. What's killing me are these defects that I'm not only not getting rid of, I'm encouraging. You know, I'm watering them like a little flower. I'm so right. I'm mind-shatteringly right. And then it says we do a fearless. And we write a fearless. It's such an interesting presentation. It says we write fears not in connection with personal resentment. Now, I'm frightened of the police, but I've been knocking over 7-Elevens. And I'm resentful at myself for knocking over 7-Eleven. So the fear of the police is not a real fear. It's going to lead me to writing more resentments. I'm frightened of success. I'm frightened of failure. I'm frightened of AIDS. I'm frightened of hepatitis C. I'm frightened of the dark. I'm frightened of the light. I'm frightened of being alone, and I'm frightened of being with people. How do you have a life? Once you've painted yourself into that spiritual corner, there's no oxygen left. There's no air, there's no light. How do you have a life? And I've heard these fears. Every one of them I've just mentioned, I've heard them on most of the inventories that I hear. Now, if we wanted to be nitpicking, and I find it so useless to be a nitpicker when it comes to the inventory process, I'm just talking about tools I've used that have been really helpful to me. I don't think it's the right or wrong way at all. You know, the minute I say, how can you stay sober and do that? You call that sponsorship, then I'm over sober. Then I better sit down and write those resentments so that I can be part of the deal again. You know. I could make a case for every single one of those fears having a connecting resentment to it, but I don't want to. When it presents as a fear that I experience just as pure fear, I write it on that. And when I write the fear list, I write, I am frightened of. I am frightened of sex. I am frightened of success. I am frightened of failure. Now it says that selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our problem, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. Now I've never heard an inventory with 100 forms of fear, and that's fine. I don't mind missing out on that. And if it's fear, if it's 25 of each or 100, I don't care. It's a lot. It's enough to kill me. And that's the very simple second section of the inventory as far as I can see it. It doesn't ask me to attach any quantity or any defects that feed it. It just says I write down my fears. I made a list of my fears. And then the incredible sexual inventory on page 62. For me, one of the great transforming pieces in all of our spiritual treatment, the chance I get to really implement this mysterious idea of moral psychology. It says that I'm going to write about 7 points. Where was I selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Unjustifiably aroused jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness? And what I should have done instead. Not what I could have done. Not what I could have done. Most of my love affairs look like the opening scene of a CSI episode. You should stop, Scott. Everyone's dead. You know, it was bad. It was bad. And it's not what I could have done. What I could have done was what I did. What should I have done? And in the last two paragraphs, it describes a relationship, an active, living, breathing, ongoing developmental relationship with God that I think is unequaled in our literature and in my experience. It says, in this way, I try to shape a sound, safe and sound ideal for my future sex life. I don't use the word sex. I just say for my future life. It says that I draw close to God. I tell him what I should be doing instead. What kind of man do I want to be? What kind of organ do I want to be for the ever-advancing spearhead of God's will and purpose, which is a mystery to me. But I know what it feels like to take a step away from a drink and a step toward a drink. That's the acid test for me. This is all about not drinking. 100% about not drinking. If that's the kernel of it, if the acid test for me is it a step toward a drink or away from a drink, I've heard in AA it's not about not drinking anymore, it's about living. I understand that. I don't feel that way. I feel that it's 100% about not drinking. But I'm not focused on not drinking. I'm taking these seemingly disconnected. I am focused on it when I'm trying to get you through 24 hours when you've got a week and a half and your brains are leaking out the back of your head. You know, I ask God what to do in each individual situation. I ask God to help shape me and mold me and help me walk toward that. That's a process. That's the future. That's the now. That's in the moment. Right here, right now. Because that's all that exists. My brain would have me not believe that. My brain is like a dog with a bone. You know that, and sometimes I get into my car now and I actually decide what I want to do. I actually sometimes get in my car and I go, what do you want to do? You want to think? You can think for a while. Do you want to work on this piece of writing that you got in your head? Would you like to work on that? What do you want to do? In the past, it was just I get in the car and I'm there for the ride. I'm going to do whatever the hell my brain tells. My brain, I am ravaged by thought. I'm going to do whatever my brain tells me to do, whenever it tells me to do it, forever, how long. But I actually, because of my spiritual practice, and I've been practicing this spiritual stuff, I've been doing it since I'm 6 months sober, and I'm not bragging, I'm just here to tell my story, I have not spent any appreciable amount of time in those 21 and a half years not doing it. I just haven't experienced that, of drifting away, and then stopping, and then coming back. And that just doesn't make me good, it makes me, I've had the Scott Redmond experience for the past 22 years. But I, at times, use my brain instead of my brain using me. That's remarkable. You know, if you ask a tree or an eagle what time it is, they don't care. That's psychological time. You know, and what my spiritual teachers tell me, if you have a kid, or if you have a pet, or if you're in touch with other human beings, there's a peripheral vision. Sometimes if you're with somebody who has a child and you're with them, they will perk up and leave the room because they've heard something you don't hear. You just don't hear it. They have a peripheral vision around that other being, you know. And it can happen with a pet. It can happen with a lot of different things. You literally will hear, feel a air move, and you'll react to it. And what a lot of the mystics say is, what a great way to live. To be able to live in the spirit with a peripheral vision about these worldly troubles and bothers. To be able to have a choice of whether or not to engage those instead of grinding it. I show up at my home group, and what I'm there to do right off the bat is take attendance and gather evidence. That's what I'm doing, man. I walk in, let's go, let's kill them all, and we'll sort them out later. But I'm going to start evidence gathering right away. What a terrible defect evidence gathering is.
there's just no, there's no way to, you don't win in that world at all, you know. And now I'm grinding it. I'm in reality. You're going to join me in reality, whether you like it or not, and we're going to grind. There's no, my gums are bleeding already. Instead of engaging in this incredible spiritual democracy. So what should I be doing instead? In this way, I try to shape a sound ideal for my future sex life, my future life. So the answer isn't always, I shouldn't have lied. I should have missionary-style position sex for the sole purpose of procreation for the rest of my life. And then die. Maybe my ideal is I want to have a great romance. Maybe my ideal is I want to have a great, exciting sex life, and I want to do that in a truthful and honest way, with my eyes open, and be loving and charitable and giving and give pleasure and I don't know what it is. Maybe I want to be honest and be able to not bully you with my honesty. I don't know what it is. I don't know what your ideal is. In the preceding page to that, it talks about something that I think, when the book was written, is kind of a mirror of the two school, you know, there were two AA camps, kind of, in New York and in Akron. In Akron, they were still very, very steeped and very connected to the Oxford group and to first century Christian teachings. In New York, there were a lot of deranged intellectuals and artists. Big shock there. And in, you know, Bill does this gorgeous thing. You know, he says, look, some of you might think that this is a function of our baser, you know, needs, that this is should be one flavor and that's it. And some of you think that you should just be, you know, having sex with the world, you know. And he says the beautiful thing. We will not be the arbiter of anybody's sexual behavior. We just won't do it. We've got to quit playing God, you know. So years ago, a guy came to me for help. He was engaging in a sexual behavior that was very injurious to him, and actually people were getting physically injured in it. And he came to me, he heard me share, and I showed him how to do a sexual inventory, and we did some work on it for a while, and he could not stop doing it. And he said to me, I don't know what I'm going to do. And I said, well, let's try this. Right now, you don't have God's voice in your head, you just have your voice in your head, so let's put another voice in your head. Now I'm going to tell you, if you do it again, I won't work with you anymore. And he said, okay. And he did it the next day, and he called me. He said, what are you going to do? I said, well, I'm not going to work with you anymore. And he said, you're a Nazi son of a bitch, and hung the phone up on me. And I was wrong. Here's the truth. The truth is it was too hard for me. That was the truth. It was too scary for me. I didn't know about it. I didn't know what to do with it. And I had some spiritual pride, and I wasn't able to say to him the truth. Oh, I love you. This is too hard for me. It's too confusing and it's too hard, and I can't do this with you. You know, maybe you can go to another 12-step program or talk to another person or get some therapy or go to a mental institution. I don't know what you need to do. But instead of telling him the truth, I volunteered to be the enforcer of his superego. Right? Say, well, I'll put another voice in your head. So what? You know, it's just another thing he's screwing up. Another thing he's disappointing. Another thing he's doing wrong. That's all it is, you know. So it's interesting for me to look at that. I volunteered to be the arbiter of his behavior. That's really, at the end of the day, what I did. And I did it in a lovely, giving way, which is better. Instead of having a finger in his face, you know, and the truth was, is it was, boy, what a great thing to be able to say that. This is too hard for me. It's just too hard for me, you know. Not that you're wrong and I'm right and this is the way to do it. So when a guy reads me a fifth step and if he does sexual inventories and writes about, I put the name of the people who were injured on the top of the page. Sometimes I was injured, no one else was. You know, sometimes someone else was injured and I wasn't. Sometimes I was injured, my kids, my wife, the other person's family, and there's a whole bunch of people. I put the names of the people who were injured on top of the page, and then I write about where I've been selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate, unjustifiably aroused jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness, and what I should have done instead, not what I could have done, the kind of man that I'd like to be. And as I've developed in this inventory process, when I write about, and look, I don't have to have sex to write a sexual inventory. You know, most of my sex is a very solitary endeavor anyway, but I don't have to have actually contact with another human being. This, thank God, otherwise I'd do very little writing. But this is about my relationships with people. You know, it can be about a situation at work. It can be about a situation in my marriage. It can be about the interior of all those things. And I am being selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate, unjustifiably arousing jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness. Sometimes the jealousy is, well, I'm just jealousy of people who I think are having more fun than me or having a normal life, and I don't feel normal. I feel injured and misshapen and bad, you know. It's just as ugly when I'm the arbiter of my own behavior, you know. So when a guy comes and does his fifth step, what I ask him to do is take all the pieces where he wrote what I should be doing instead. Just like I'm laying the resentments aside and bringing the defects of character to God, I ask him to take all the instances where he says what I should be doing instead and put them all in one section. So that in 6 and 7, and we're going to come back after lunch and talk about 6 and 7, which is really the big brass ring. It's really the centerpiece for my relationship with my higher power, so that he can bring that to God and then ask to be shaped, ask to walk toward that in concert with God, to have moral psychology. You know, normal psychology is, if you're neurotic, I don't know if anybody here has ever been referred to as a neurotic before, but... A neurosis is a couple of people are laughing. Little identification, me too. Is if you have anxiety, and then you come up with a way to resolve the anxiety, and it's a bad idea. It's just a bad idea. It's like I swallow all the nitroglycerin and start smashing my body into the wall trying to explode. Actually, my solution's worse than my problem. Okay, I don't know if that resonates for anybody here. My dental problem that I was going to relieve with a hot needle into my gum. So I go to therapy, and what the idea of most conventional therapy is to uncover, discover, and unravel, to free associate, to delve into my past, and to come up with a better resolution for my anxiety. It works for millions of people. It's used all over the planet. But I have alcoholism. So I go to therapy. The therapist says, "How are you?" I said, "Terrible." "Why?" "Well, yesterday I was too drunk to walk, so I drove." "Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about it. Let me ask you a question. What were you thinking just before you did it?" "Nothing." "How do you feel?" "Terrible. I feel terrible." "Why?" "Well, yesterday I sharpened a hypodermic needle on the back of a matchbook striker and sucked some heroin up through a fluffed up cigarette filter and I injected it. I just feel miserable." "What were you thinking just before you did it?" "Nothing." "Nothing. And I'm telling the truth. I'm telling the truth. My mouth flooded with saliva. The room spun. I went out for cigarettes and wound up in Baltimore. And that's all I remember. Nothing." Treat that. Treat nothing. You would need a panel of therapists working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to put my crap in a file and put it on a shelf. My alcoholism is so efficient in generating pathology, neurosis, difficult times, hurt feelings, broken experiences. You can't, it's not a fair fight. Absolutely not a fair fight. Boy, how did I fall down this rabbit hole? I'm usually pretty good. I don't even know how I wound up here. Thank God it's almost over. Moral psychology is to uncover, discover, and apply. That with regular psychology, to come up with a better resolution for my anxiety is a very successful thing to do, and millions of people do it. And what I have to do is uncover, discover, and have a moral application for my self-discovery. Because when I go to you and I sit you down and I give you instructions on how to do a sexual inventory, and I am a free man, I'm a free man. I've still got problems. No, really. I've had problems in sobriety. Really, really. I know there are people who haven't, and I'm so, so glad for them. I am not in their numbers. I've had plenty of problems, you know, with sex, with money, with all sorts of stuff in sobriety, and that's why I've hung out with people who talk about that later on in sobriety. Otherwise, I'll be sober with a gun in my mouth, you know.
And, you know, it's so funny. Some of the guys I sponsor get very angry at themselves when they have to do a 10-step or they have a resentment. And one of the things I'm fond of saying is, you know, I get the common cold a couple of times a year. Why do you think you can move through this landscape of life and not get spiritually sick once in a while? I mean, my problem is I'm spiritually sick. My problem is I'm separated. I'm separated by a self-centeredness that keeps me in the loop of active alcoholism. I get really scared when a guy's never got anything, never got any business. And by the way, I don't have a jaundiced view of that. I think there are some people who really just get free and stay free, and that's fine. And I'm happy for them. I'm just not in their number. I might be someday. I don't feel particularly close at this point, but I live pretty free most of the time. At any rate, that form of moral psychology to me is expressed so beautifully in the sexual inventory about joining in a relationship with God and moving forward and being shaped and in that partnership with my higher power. My sons are 28 and 25. They were 6 and 3 when I got sober. And years ago, when my son Micah was babysitting for a guy on this couple in the fellowship, and this guy said to him, he was about 19 at the time, said to him, what do you think of your dad talking in AA? And my son said, you know, I'm not a member. I'm awfully happy for him. I think it's great, but I, you know. And Micah said to him, all I can tell you is since I'm a very, very little boy, the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon have taken very, very good care of me, and never once has any of them demanded that I believe what they believe. Wow. Wow. What an extraordinary thing. Talk about not playing God. Talk about not playing God being mirrored in his personal experience as a member of an AA Al-Anon family. You know? Anyway, you guys have been so attentive. You're either like on speed or just really, I can't tell you. You've really fed me beautifully through this morning. Thank you for your patience. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. Thank you.